Van McCracken, president of the Rio Grande Valley Kiwanis Club.
Good evening,
Ann. Ann, and if you would remain standing after the flag salute, our invocation today will be given by Pastor Robert Banker from the Open Door Church.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America
and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Our Father, we give thanks unto you tonight for this privilege and opportunity of coming to you in prayer. We thank you for this, the wonderful privilege that we have to be able to have this freedom. And Father, we pray for our troops in various parts of the world, especially for those that are in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we ask your watch care over them and that you would bring them home safely. We thank you for Kiwanis and for the things that they achieve in our community to benefit our children. Father, we pause to remember the Public Works Department of our nation and honor them. And Father, we just pray that they might be blessed for their labor as they make our lives more pleasant. And then for our police force, and especially on this week from Wednesday when we remember those who have given their life for us in order that we might be safe in our communities. Father, we ask your blessing upon the council tonight and for the service that they perform. This we ask in our Savior's name. Amen.
Well, Ann, don't get too far away. I'm going to let you talk. Not only do you get to tell us what Kiwanis is doing these days, but you got a prayer as well.
So isn't that wonderful?
That was a great thing.
From a fellow Kiwanian. Just happens to be in a different club in a different town. I would like to invite all of you to our annual spring barbecue. This is about, I think, our fifth year we've been doing it. Some of you may know Mary Bassett. She's our chairperson this year, and it's going to be at JJ's Supermarket. We're going to start serving around 11 a.m., and you can buy your tickets on site. So we invite all of you to, this Saturday the 13th. Thanks, Kelly. That'll be this Saturday the 13th. And then, of course, don't forget to stop by our strawberry daiquiri booth at the Harvest Festival. And that'll be the end of the month. And that's about it right now for this month.
That's enough.
Yes.
Good.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ann.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. That takes us to item 5, special presentations. We have two this evening, and I'll step down from the dais to present those. And Don, you're on your way up. Don Spagnola, our Public Works Director. Is this mic on? Don, it's my pleasure this evening to present this honorary proclamation recognizing National Public Works Week, May 15th through May 21st. And I'll read a portion of it. Whereas public works services provided in our community are an integral part of our citizens' everyday lives, and whereas the support of an outstanding and informed citizenry is vital to the efficient operation of public works systems, and to recognize the contributions which public works professionals make every day to our health, safety, comfort, and quality of life. So, Don, it's a pleasure to present this to you, and would welcome you to say a few words.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, members of the council. this year, as always, American Public Works Week, or National Public Works Week, is a time for education and awareness of the public works, things that we do in the public works field in our profession. This year, our education efforts are going to be centered around our theme. And this year's theme is Public Works is Everywhere You Look. So we're going to have some education opportunities at our office. We're also going to open up the Corporation Yard for for people who want to come down and visit and see about all the things that Public Works does. We also are going to be participating along with the county and Caltrans in the San Luis Obispo Farmers Market on the 19th Thursday. So hopefully, if you get a chance, come on down and look at all the things we have to show you. So with that, thank you very much.
Thank you. All right. right. At this time, our second proclamation this evening is an honorary proclamation recognizing National Police Week. And Officer Michelle Cota, you're going to accept this? I'd rather have her accept this than the chief anyway. So it's my pleasure to present this to you this evening, and I'll read a portion of it as well. Whereas all of the promises America offers, none is more precious or more elusive than the right to be free from crime and violence. And whereas the dedicated men and women who have chosen law enforcement as a career face extraordinary risk and danger in preserving our freedom and security. And whereas during the week of May 15 through 21st, 2005, National Police Week is observed throughout the nation in order to recognize the hazardous work, serious responsibilities, and strong commitment of our nation's peace officers. And whereas in conjunction with this important observance, May 18th, 2005, is observed as Peace Officers Memorial Day in San Luis Obispo County in commemoration of those noble officers who have tragically sacrificed their lives in the line of duty, including 11 peace officers who died in the line of duty in California during the past 12 months. And whereas these special observances provide all Californians with the opportunity to appreciate the heroic men and women who have dedicated their lives to preserving public safety, and whereas the city of Arroyo Grande desires to honor the valor, service, and dedication of its own police officers, now therefore be it resolved that I, Tony Ferrara, mayor of the city of Arroyo Grande, again on behalf of the city council, do hereby proclaim May 15 through 21st, 2005, as National Police Week, and May 18th, 2005, as Peace Officers Memorial Day in the city of Arroyo Grande. And we urge all citizens of our community to demonstrate their sincere appreciation and gratitude to the police officers by deed, remark, and attitude. So, Michelle, it's my pleasure to present this to you. And once again, if you'd like to say a few words, we would be grateful.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Council, Mayor. I'm Officer Michelle Cota with the Arroyo Grande Police Department. I'm also the president of the Arroyo Grande Police Office of the 21st. They help raise funds for the memorial that's up in front of the state capitol in Sacramento. I myself visited there last week for the state memorial for the police officers, and it's a very, very moving tribute. For those that can't make it that far, we do have one here on the Central Coast that's extremely moving, and it's a tribute. It's on the 18th. It's up at the Paso Robles Public Safety Center, and I highly encourage you. It starts at 9 o'clock in the morning. It's on Wednesday. If at all possible, if you could make it to that, it's a wonderful tribute to the officers, past and present, that have laid down their lives. Thank you very much for this proclamation.
Thank you, Michelle. Did they move the venue from Mission Plaza?
Yes, they did.
To Paso this year?
Yes, they did.
Okay, good. Thank you so much. Okay, that takes us to item 6, agenda review. Move that all resolutions and ordinances presented tonight be read in title only, and all further readings be waived.
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Hearing none. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion carries. That takes us to item 7, community comments and suggestions. This is an opportunity for members of the audience to come forward and make observations and comments on items that are not scheduled on this agenda. The Brown Act restricts the council from taking any formal action on matters that are not published on the agenda. We would ask that you limit your comments to 3 minutes or less, and please address the council as a whole. Is there anyone who would like to come forward during community comments? I went through all the ground rules for nothing. Okay. Then we will close item 7. That will take us to item 8, consent agenda. Once again, this is a group of items that we normally approve in one action unless there is an item on the agenda that members of the council would like to pull for further clarification and independent action. What is the will of the council?
Mr. Mayor, I'd like to pull 8E.
8E?
8E.
Okay. Any others?
8E was mine as well.
Okay.
And also 8I.
Any others? If there are no others, I will entertain a motion for approval of consent items 8A through 8J, with the exception of 8E and 8I.
So moved.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Anything to read in there, Tim?
I'm afraid there is, Mayor Ferrara. It's item 8H is an ordinance of the City Council of the City of Rio Grande amending Rio Grande Municipal Code Chapter 16.36 of Title 16 to include permitting requirements applicable to auto vehicle parts sales without installation services in commercial and mixed-use districts, and adding Chapter 10.18 to Title 10 to prohibit auto-related maintenance and repair activity in commercial and public parking lots, Development Code Amendment 05-007.
Okay, thank you. That will take us to consent item 8.
The only thing that concerns me a bit about this is that I know that we're getting close to 100% of water use, as are some of our neighbors. Does this simply give any of us license to just start drawing as much water as we want until suddenly all of us are in overdraft?
I wouldn't say it gives us license to begin drawing as much water as we need until we hit overdraft. The intent is to provide the capability on a temporary basis to meet water needs as long as cumulatively we're not exceeding our safe yield. Within the term, especially Section 3, lays out some terms of the agreement. One in particular, E, is failure by any of the parties to actively pursue other water sources and to institute water conservation members would be grounds for termination of the agreement. So once again, the intent of this agreement is specifically to allow cities, if they have a period of time where they're instituting new measures and are going to go over for a temporary period of time, it allows them to do that while they get the measures in. If for other reasons there is some kind of periodic use that's necessary. If we felt that any of the cities were abusing this agreement and not operating it as according to that intent, then I believe our action would be to move to terminate the agreement based on those terms.
And that can be terminated by any of the members of the party, any parties of the agreement?
Correct.
Thank you.
Any other comments, questions on 8E? Councilmember Dickens?
I had a couple. Steve or Don, just a couple items that I'd like to just point out. One is part of the agreement talks about on page 3, item 4, monitoring and reporting. Apparently, per our current agreement, we have quarterly meetings between the jurisdictions in question. What I was hoping to request at the council's indulgence is that we could actually get a report from those meetings, very similar to reports that we receive for other items. And within that report, I'd like to be able to, and I don't know whether you guys actually discuss or actually document the amount of pumping that was done during that quarter or not, but if so, if that could be accumulated and then just sent off to council in our packets just so we could review that. And then the second thing I would like to request as part of this is that there needs to be a written, as part of the agreement, I believe, the party that wants to exceed its allocations must do something in writing, I believe, at these quarterly meetings. And when that's determined that the City of Arroyo Grande were to pump over our current allocations, then I would like to have a copy of that as well.
I think that's a great idea. Yeah. We'll follow up on that.
And then just a couple of items that I would like to – there's an addition of a typo, page 1 under item C. I believe it's the second sentence. There just needs to be the A needs to be added in. While the cities agree to a total of 4,000 acre feet, I believe just needs to be added there. And I would also like to add, if appropriate, under page 2, item 3 under
8E.
What's the timetable for the other cities to consider this? Is it all happening?
I know the City of Grover Beach is placing it on their agenda next week. The other two jurisdictions said they'd be moving ahead quickly. They've already discussed it with their councils, so I expect within the next 2 to 3 weeks it would be all finalized.
Any other comments on 8E? Okay, hearing none, I'll entertain a motion.
Move for approval of consideration of the internal water allocation agreement.
As amended?
As amended, thank you.
Okay. Is there a second?
I'll second that.
Okay, there's a motion and a second. Roll call, please.
Councilmember
Diggins? Yes.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Arnold?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. And that takes us to 8I. Again, Mayor Pro Tem?
Thank you again, Mr. Mayor. This item is consideration of a 2005 Regional Transportation Enhancement Funding Application for Phase 4 of the Scenic Creekside Walk Through the Historic Village of Rio Grande Project. And it's calling for us to request a little bit over $500,000 for transportation enhancement funds for Phase 4. The question I have is it reasonable to expect that these dollars are going to be available with the state of dollars coming from the state?
It's my understanding that the SLOCOG did receive an estimate of $4.6 million, and they had allocated only about half of that previously, so they still have about $2.4 million that they're going to be allocating or allotting in this funding cycle. So I believe the funds are available.
Yeah, they will be available.
Yeah.
That was my only concern, Mr. Mayor.
We did get feedback that, one, this project is, they believe, is competitive. But with the low number of funding that may require, they may have to come back and ask us to scale down the project in terms of funding availability.
I just have a couple of comments on this, Don. Did we program any crosswalk money in here or funding in here at all?
Crosswalk money, I'm not sure. I don't think so. The money that we have... Local funds we haven't determined yet, but once we've gotten the okay from SLOCOG, then we'll program the local funding, which will come back to you at some time. But I don't think we'll be anticipating using anything that would be used for sidewalks.
We were working on some sidewalk improvements and streetscape improvements in the village, as you know, the streetscape project, but we weren't able to get Caltrans approval in time for this particular funding cycle. Instead, we're targeting SHA funds, a grant that would be due in September for that particular project.
Okay. Well, the TE money is the one source of funding that fortunately we have access to, and fortunately SLOCOG has, in answer to your question, Mayor Pro Tem, they have some substantial funds to allocate for that purpose. Just about every other source of transportation money is gone. But this is one aspect that deals with enhancement, transportation enhancement, where we do have access to it. So they have called for a list of projects. And I think we mentioned that at the last meeting that we were hoping.
We didn't do a roll call vote for.
I thought we did.
No.
For.
We got a motion and a second, and then.
I think he said that also I did.
Yeah. No, I think we did do a roll call. I thought we did. For, are you talking about 8E?
No, for the first round.
Oh, jeez.
We were asleep at the wheel, Your Honor.
Where were you?
I was thinking about 8E.
Oh, okay.
I have it ready to go. We have a motion.
In addition to the notes, Kelly, I need a sign, a flashing sign that the audience can't see.
Okay.
All right. All right, so let's do a roll call then on consent items 8A. Through 8J, with the exception of 8E and 8I, which we've already done.
Yes, correct.
Will that get it?
Yes. Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Dickens?
Yes.
And Councilmember Arnold?
Yes.
Mayor Ferrara?
Yes.
Thank you.
Actually, it took Tim so long to read those I completely forgot. How am I doing at passing the buck? Okay, public hearings. First one this evening is 9A, consideration of a 2005 water sewer rate study.
Mr. Mayor, members of the council, this item was scheduled to be on your agenda at this time, but we've We'd like a little bit more time to develop some more information and come back to you at the June 14th meeting.
Okay. So your recommendation is that we postpone this until June 14th?
June 14th, yes.
All right. Anyone have an issue with that? You need a motion on this, Steve? Need a motion to continue this? Okay. Is there anyone here that wanted to participate and comment on item 9A, the water sewer rate study? Okay, no public comment, so we'll entertain a motion to continue this item.
Mr. Mayor, I'd move that we continue item 9A, consideration of the 2005 water and sewer rates study and proposed resolutions establishing new water and sewer rates and charges to the meeting of June 14th.
Second.
Okay, a motion and a second. Roll call, please.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello.
Yes.
Councilmember Arnold.
Yes.
Councilmember Dickens.
Yes.
Councilmember Guthrie.
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara.
Yes. Takes us to 9B, consideration of a conditional use permit. Case number 04-009. Applicant is Gary White, Hampton Inn and Suites Hotel and Restaurant, 1400 West Branch.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, Council Members. This is conditional use permit case 04009 for Hampton Inn and Suites. I just want to give you a quick synopsis of the project and turn it over to you. Although this project has been advertised as a conditional use permit, tonight staff requests that the council review this project and give comments as if it were a pre-application. It is a 2.68-acre parcel on the corner of West Branch Street and Camino Mercado. The project or the site slopes initially pretty steeply from West Branch, then it slightly slopes as you go north. Currently, the site has vegetation of native and non-native species, including mature oak trees. Surrounding uses include the Premier Inn, offices, the cemetery, and Levitt's. On the screen is an aerial photo, and just to orient the public, this is the site, the Premier Inn above it, Camino Mercado with the Mid-State Bank offices, a cemetery, this is West Branch Street and the freeway, and this is the Levitt's building here. The project is proposed as a 104-unit Hampton Inn and Suites, three stories plus a basement, totaling 60,323 square feet. The applicant also proposes a 6,000-square-foot restaurant on a separate parcel. The project proposes 130 off-street parking spaces, entry and exit from Camino Mercado. The project will proposes to utilize retaining walls of varying heights, and the applicant does propose to remove or relocate 6 of the 12 oak trees on the property. On the screen is a site plan, and to help orient you, this is West Branch Street and Camino Mercado. On the corner, the applicant wishes to put the 6,000-square-foot restaurant. Above that, towards the Levitt's building, is a L-shaped hotel. The two entries from Camino Mercado are here. The rest is parking lots, landscaping, including a cluster of three oak trees that are on the site, pool and spa towards this area. The applicant has provided color renderings of the site, and they are here for your closer inspection, and we could also put them on the screen. And they've also included elevations of the project. I have them if you need to point to them and talk further about it. With that, staff recommends that the City Council review the project and give direction to staff and to the applicant related to the building design, the site design, environmental determination, and future development code amendment, tentative parcel map, and specific development plan and conditional use permit applications, and also to continue the item to June 14, 2005. With that, I can answer any questions, and Rob Strong, as usual, here is here to field the tough ones. And the applicant and his representative is here also.
Thank you. Any questions for staff? Questions, clarifications? Yes.
I had one question, Mr. Mayor. In the report, it mentions that the hotel is projected to use 15.6 acre feet of water and the restaurant is 3.0. acre feet. Do we have any? Do you recall what the office was projected to use? And I, if you don't, I apologize because I missed it earlier and I picked it up this afternoon. So.
Commission, and unfortunately, I haven't had a chance to get the answer to that. I assume it's considerably less. An office project doesn't have near the demand for water as a hotel and restaurant.
That's all clarification.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Okay. Any other questions, clarifications? Councilmember Dickens?
Mr. Tells in our city, and then was able to figure out how much each room used. So really, that is the typical water use of a hotel now. I'm not sure if say, the Econo Lodge now uses water-saving devices. I assume that this hotel, since it's brand new, would be able to use less than that, but that's pure speculation.
So let me take that one step further then. If we have 1, 2, 3, 4 mitigation measures dealing specifically with mitigating the use of water, all four of which, in my opinion, are already part of our development code. These are, for the most part, they would be reasonable mm-hmm. conservation practices that would be required per our development code anyways. Are they really mitigation measures? What is it mitigating?
It's going back to the existing hotels and not knowing whether they use low-flow toilets or low-flow shower heads. I'm sure we have programs that are trying to encourage people to retroactively fix these problems. I think there's a lot of variation also in site and topography and how much green area you have and using native vegetation. So the question really becomes, is it going to be implemented now and so that we're sure that it's being used? And also there is a mitigation measure in there to put into place a program that encourages hotels to reuse linens, not wash the sheets every day if the people request that. These are simple things that hotels can do to reduce the amount of water, and I believe that they will work and help to mitigate the water use.
Okay. Do we have an idea, or has there been a calculation, this may be a question for Don, of the traffic impact fees that this project's anticipated or expected to pay?
If we've done a complete estimate of the fees. Jim, have we done a complete an estimate of the traffic fees for this?
Right now it's listed as pay the traffic fees when you pull a building permit, so I do not know the total.
We don't. I guess we haven't done a complete calculation of all the impact fees at this point.
So that's typically not something we do. We don't have an estimate of what we're looking at doing.
Not at the pre-app stage unless it's requested by the applicant. Because those are normally paid at the building permit stage, which is further.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions, clarifications on this item?
I just have one, Mr. Mayor. It was my understanding from reading the Planning Commission meetings that the reason that this would be CUP denied and actually would be brought back later is because you want it to become a general plan amendment and go back to being a PD. Am I understanding that correctly? And why would that... Why would that be necessary?
The idea is to this project fits mostly with the office mixed-use area, although we do realize that it's a sloping site. It's a site that's very accessible, and it's a site in order to get a building that is, say, appropriate for Arroyo Grande, but keep the size that makes it economically feasible. It is over the allowed size of 50,000.
To members of the audience to come forward to comment on item 9B, and we typically allow the applicant to go first.
City Councilman. Since we appeared before you, we have made significant design changes to the project.
Excuse me, could I get you to state your name for the record, please?
Sorry. My name is Bob Tuttle. I'm the architect for the project, working with Gary White and Steve Kuhl, as well as American Properties Management. Since we appeared before you a few months ago, we have revised the building design, eliminating one story completely from the project, which initially was a four-story project with a basement area. And we've extended the building into the hill toward the other hotel and also toward the restaurant pad in order to maintain the approximate number of rooms that we had in our financial pro forma. We feel the hotel is probably the highest and best use for this site. The issue of oak trees has been raised by several on the Planning Commission, and just a few days ago we received a revised report from our arborist. And we are attempting to preserve the trees as much as possible. The arborist report recommends removing trees 2, 4, 5, and 6, as well as tree number 9. There are numbers on there. They're very small. I don't know if you can see the numbers on those trees or not, but there are numbers on each of the trees. And you'll see that 2 of the trees, 4 and 5, are directly in the building footprint. 6 and 7 are also directly under the building footprint, and these trees are recommended to be, they're in good health and recommended to be transplanted or moved. And tree number 3 is also very close to the building. I don't think we'll be able to save tree number 3. There would probably, with a little further study, be the ability to relocate and or replace some of the healthy trees with some of the trees that need to be replaced or that are not healthy. The main entrance to the building,
which occurs right here, we have a cluster of oak trees that we would like those to become.
Thank you. We'd like these three trees to become the focal point of the main entrance, and we'll have a trellis which will extend out into the trees. And I've done a comparison just briefly for your information to compare the building elevations of two neighboring buildings. One is the Trader Joe's building, and in the upper diagram you will see this is the approximate elevation from street grade as the street comes up. There's a large hill with Trader Joe's sitting on the top of the hill. By comparison, you can see the elevation of the hotel. There's a difference of 63 feet in total height difference between the proposed Hampton Inn and Suites and the elevation of Trader Joe's, just to kind of give you a comparison. And then the second illustration is the Walmart elevation. Total surface area is approximately 11,520 square feet. And the dominant elevation of the proposed Hampton Inn, which is the south-facing elevation, is about 5,985 square feet. It's approximately half the size of that elevation. These are just to give you an idea of the comparison in visual size and impact. I'd also mention that the Trader Joe's has an extra significant impact because it's viewed from below, and as you're looking up, it appears even taller because you are viewing from a lower angle, and there's nothing to block that view. The proposed Hampton Inn is viewed from below on the freeway is this elevation here. And when I presented this drawing in the Planning Commission, the chairman challenged me and said there are not that many trees that will be blocking the view of the hotel. But I told him that we had taken this rendering from an actual photograph, and this photograph, you can see very faintly how the building model is superimposed into the photograph. And there are a large number of existing trees that are located along this slope here that do tend to buffer the west elevation of the proposed hotel. The design of the building is intended to be a Mediterranean style with smooth, simple faces and simple materials. The window surrounds and the trims on the building will be a smooth troweled stucco finish that will have the appearance of concrete or stone. There are exposed rafters at the roof eaves all the way around the building, and there's a proposed concrete S-tile roof for the building. We're also proposing a central tower that would act as a landmark, Royal Grande, and that the building is nestled into the hillside. The most dominant elevation is the south elevation, and you can see that elevation here with the proposed restaurant building adjoining it. And the design review group has suggested a trellis and some decks at this location here to tie the two buildings together with some decks and a trellis. And those items are on our drawings, although you don't see them here in this rendering. We are moving in that direction to add more detail and also to bring the mass of the building out and step it back here on that elevation. We believe that the number of rooms and the site utilization with its access and visibility will provide a very successful hotel, which would be an asset to the community of Arroyo Grande. And with that, I'd welcome any questions that you might have.
Well, I've got a burning question, and I'm trying to reconcile the photograph that you passed out with the artist's rendering. And the first thing that comes to mind is the proximity of the hotel itself relative to the sidewalk in the photo. In comparison to the artist's rendering, the one in the photo, if you look at the one in the photo, it looks as if the south face is almost at the sidewalk, and I'm looking at something that I hope is not indicative of the direction that you want to go, and that appears to be a substantial wall or retaining wall in this photo.
That is a little misleading in the photo, because that is the grade and the ground that's built up in the model to represent the grade. It is not a proposed wall or anything at that point.
So am I to understand then that the artist rendering accurately represents the positioning of the structure relative to the sidewalk, and most importantly the slope grade?
Yes, there's approximately, I believe it was a 20-foot setback on that side from the street to the face of the building, and there's approximately 15 feet of slope at the highest point. And on the lower end toward the restaurant, there's about 6 foot of vertical slope, but there is about a 20-foot setback of the building from the sidewalk at that point.
Questions for the applicant? None?
Just real quickly, the difference between this and the other building, it's essentially the same number of rooms. You've lost what looks like about 20,000 square feet. I mean, we were told it was about 75 before.
We may have lost some rooms.
Looks like a wall is just really the base of the model, not part of the building. It's a little bit hard to read, but the building is as accurately placed as I think it can be.
I guess, and I have to admit, I haven't spent a lot of time with the model, which probably we should take a break at some point and do. But it would appear that the tower element in that model is farther east than it is in this picture. Now, it may be the perspective of where the camera is sitting, but the tower element looks like it's almost directly over, you know, the center of Levitt's, whereas in that particular picture, the tower element is clearly east of the Levitt's building.
Right, but I believe the Levitt's building is an L-shaped building, and you're only seeing a piece of it there, and I believe that the front of it turns and goes across in that direction, and I think that's the reason for that.
Any other questions?
Actually, I had one, Mr. Mayor.
Okay.
In the architectural review, on page 11, they made reference to these are their suggestions for acceptance, and one of them was item 3, which was consider possible redesign of the front tower to be less rectangular, more similar to the other roof pitches. Have you incorporated that change into here? Because I didn't see really a rectangle tower when I'm.
No, I have not incorporated that recommended change.
The rectangular tower they're talking about is this element here. Okay. And I was going to kind of personally try to keep it because I felt like it added character to the building and a uniqueness that we could easily take it off, but I felt like just architecturally I'd prefer to have it. But if someone really got excited about it, we could very easily remove that tower.
Councilmember Dickens?
Yeah, Bob, if you don't mind, can you tell me what the elevation would be for just the building directly off of, what would that be, West Branch? So the elevation of the three stories.
Right here?
Correct.
This is approximately 15 feet. This represents the sidewalk coming up here in the street. And it's approximately 15 feet from the sidewalk to this first level. And from the first level to the bottom of the eave is approximately 30 feet. And to the average roof height is 38 feet.
Okay. And it talks about in the staff report that in addition to the oak trees, 7 small Monterey cypress trees near the Camino Mercado sidewalk would be replaced. I'm assuming that's on the those aren't being depicted on the model before.
No, I'm not sure where those are, but we had planned to do as recommended there.
There are no plans to remove any of the trees, the mature trees that are depicted between Levitt's and the proposed project?
No. If anything, we'd probably add some more trees.
Thank you.
While we're on the tree issue, I know this came up, and I can't recall. It's been a long time since Mr. White and Mr. Kuhl came forward with the office project.
Comes around, I was planning to go out and photograph each tree and have them by numbers so you could look at them. Some of the trees appear to have been tipped over, and they have multiple trunks growing out of them. As you can see in some of the recommendations from the arborist, that some trees are healthier than others. As this if this comes in at a formal application, we'll be sure to have as much information of the oak trees on site as possible.
You know which tree I'm talking
about? I'm not sure, but the largest tree is this tree. And it is, according to the arborist report, is not a healthy tree, and he's recommending that this one be taken out. These are relatively, on the model, relatively close to the size, as near as we could tell. I don't know if that's the tree he's talking about. There's no mention of a landmark oak tree in the arborist report. He mentions each tree, but he does not mention a landmark oak.
Well, I know there's a lot of discussion at the time that, you know, whether or not some of the trees that were not, quote, not healthy could in fact be made healthy through some intervention. And that was always an issue and always a question before we go in and start taking down oak trees simply because they're, quote, not healthy. Can they be made healthy? And if so, in some way, through the design, be accommodated and preserved, which I believe is our, at least some of us, if not all of us, has always been a priority. So that's sort of an observation. Any other questions?
Mayor Pro Tem. We're talking about trees. You're saying that you propose moving some of these trees. Where do you propose moving the trees you're talking about? Staying on the site somewhere?
Yeah, staying on the site. We have not completed a complete landscape plan yet, but that would be one of our next efforts in design is to, now that this arborist report that I just handed the mayor, which is completed a couple days ago, and he does indicate that a number of the trees are healthier than they were at the time, and mostly because of the wet weather we've had. And so we need to reevaluate all the trees based on the current information and see what we can do.
Is this staff's copy, by the way?
Probably should be, yeah.
Maybe you can make distribution for this if...
You bet.
Yes. Mayor and members of the council, I was going to add that one of the conditions of approval stipulates that a tree preservation landscape plan would be submitted to the Architectural Review Committee, reviewed by Parks Facilities, the City Arborist, and Community Development Director prior to formal approval. So this is one of the conditions of approval. We are looking basically at trying to save any of the trees that possibly could be retained and to transplant trees to replace trees that are unhealthy or decided to be removed, several of which are within the building footprint. There are some healthy trees within the building footprint. There are some unhealthy trees outside the building footprint that may need replacement. And further, there is a condition of mitigation if transplanting doesn't occur to use specimen planting on a 3-to-1 replacement basis if any oaks are determined to be necessary to remove. But this is a further design refinement that would come back to the Architecture Review Committee and staff before any formal action on the project.
Final action. Any other questions for the applicant at this time? No? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Anyone else who would like to come forward on this item? No one? Okay. We will close the public hearing portion of this particular item and bring it back for discussion. Councilmember Arnold, why don't you start us off here?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I'm very impressed with what we've seen tonight. I know this has been a very challenging site. I know the city would like to see a hotel put on this property. I think there was some discussion after our last meeting that if we felt that we were going to get what we saw, we probably would have approved it right then and there. I feel that there's been a lot of scrutiny as to making sure that we don't end up with something that we're all going to regret later. The notes that the ARC made specifically, and I'm just going to read them so everyone knows that these I agree completely with. Definitely considering the enhanced horizontal articulation on Branch Street side facade, including trellises and terraces, which the architect has mentioned. Continue the design theme to the restaurant and require that it be architecturally compatible to the hotel. They were concerned about the rectangle tower element. I actually think the tower element looks fine, so I wouldn't be necessarily encouraging that change, or at least especially not deleting it. They also mention a traffic study on the lower parking lot, and that would be adjacent to where the restaurant is. And I would also like to explore the possibility of that being possibly an exit only, if not both ways,
I see that possibly jamming up a little bit down there with people coming in and out of the restaurant and people having to turn around down there. Let's see, what other items did they mention? As long as we come up with ways to break up the massing, I'm not as concerned about whether we step the upper floors back, but I do agree that we need to do something, whether that is done with landscaping. And that would be one of the things that I would like to stress here is looking at the model here, we've got what are depicted as very large trees. And I think that is really going to be very important to this project, that we don't put in 24-gallon boxes and say in 10 years it's going to be a nice buffer. You know, I love the live oak as much as everyone else, but I wouldn't want to see small live oaks planted on the site with the thought that in 100 years they'll be doing the job. So I would be looking for faster-growing, probably 48-inch boxes along that frontage there, definitely to immediately do some of the buffering that we'd be looking for. I agree with the recommendation that the Branch Street colors I find more pleasant than the ones that are seen from the Oak Park rendering. So I'd be encouraging the colors along that theme. I definitely agree with using the high-quality barrel tile as well as the smooth stucco. But based on what I'm seeing tonight from the applicant, I would encourage this project to continue to move forward. I have to say that I'm definitely concerned as far as the utilities go, as far as the water and sewer, and I think we'll have to be totally comfortable that the resources are there. But assuming those can be proven, I could support this project. Thank you.
Okay. Councilmember Guthrie.
Well, I guess I've gone back and forth on this a number of times. First, I do think that this, compared to the other office building, is in fact, you know, has several things that are much better. I mean, the fact that we've lost the entry onto Branch Avenue, I think both helps the development of this site, helps the circulation in the area, and more importantly, allows for better use of this piece of property, and that the building can be built lower on the hill instead of having to be built at the very top of the hill. The problem I have is that while we've certainly relocated the building and helped the circulation, we've increased the size of the building by almost threefold over the office building. And so pretty much everything that we gained from that prospect we lost. So I think the building's still too big. I understand there may be reasons why it has to be 105 units instead of 75 units or something like that, but it's just too big a building for this site. I wouldn't be able to support it going forward. I also think that there are many ways to perhaps soften the facade here. I just don't trust the whole landscape concept. I think if you look at the hillside just east of this, you'll see what happened when we were depending on landscape to soften what was a very severe cut into the bluff there, and the landscape just never delivered. I mean, it looks like a forest fire went through there. So I'm not as confident that the landscape could expect the landscape to turn out as it appears either in the model or in the renderings. So I wouldn't be able to support it a building of this scale on this site. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Councilmember, I'm sorry.
One other thing. I'm sorry. Just on the water issue, the 15 acre feet, I agree, when you think of the entire picture, is a relatively small amount. But when you consider how close we are to the end of that we're talking about exceeding our currently available water, I think we have to also consider whether we really have that water available to extend to this kind of a project. Thanks.
Thank you. Councilmember Dickens.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. A couple of comments that I have. I guess my biggest issue with the proposed project as designed is still going to be the height and the maximum building size. I think you've done a great job with softening the the building in regards to what we saw at the first pre-application, and I think we're moving in the right direction. I certainly am supportive of a hotel use and restaurant, if indeed we can do the restaurant on this particular site, but I still believe that this site is going to be difficult to put the amount of units that you're looking for in this hotel. I think that my suggestion would be that if indeed that it's going to be a struggle to reduce the number of units lower than 104 now, that I would like to see the mass is just too much right off of West Branch. We're talking about a 45-foot to 53-foot height difference from you're sitting in a car with only approximately 20 feet distance. And I think that's just – it's going to be very obtrusive. I don't think a 20-foot you're showing fairly large trees within that particular area. You're not going to get the canopy, and, of course, you're not going to want to block the views with those amount of trees as it's being presented today. And so I think that's a little deceiving in regards to the nature of right up against West Branch. I'd like to see the project pushed back at least another 20 feet or more, and I think that it can be accommodated. When we look at parking, we are currently you're looking at proposing 130 parking spaces. And the project requirement is only 106. So it's great that we're a little overparked. I don't mind that. But we could lose some parking spaces next to the pool in that back area, push this unit back. And I think that it can. We would have the ability to then soften the intensity right up against West Branch. In regards to the oak trees, I think it's imperative that we try to save tree number 3 in its location, which means moving most likely the building or cutting off the building or so forth, losing a portion of that end. I'd like to see tree number 2 stay. I think that's the tree that Mayor Farrar is referring to in regards to its significance. And I know I differed with the arborist report when this came before us before. That was the tree that was slated, in my opinion, in my assumption, for removal. And it's probably the largest tree on the site. And it certainly is an oak tree that is in its declining years. But I can guarantee you it's going to be declining for the next 50 years, probably longer than this building will be in place. So it's still a beautiful tree. There are two areas that the staff report talks about that I think are something that we need to consider from a policy standpoint. One, water and traffic. In the staff report, it talks about the project's contribution is considered de minimis in relations to the whole. And I would say, yes, that's correct. But what does this project bring to the table over and above what is really required in regards to water and traffic? Because there will be those are issues that we're going to be having to address. The mitigation measures that are being presented are good measures in regards to the water, but I think those are standard. I think that if we looked across the board, every hotel that's being built today is going to have water-saving features. Every hotel is going to have these, and I can go through them, this Project Planet linens and towels reuse program. I mean, every time I go into a hotel, that's pretty standard. So I don't see anything that's sitting here saying, what is this project going to bring over and above what would already be considered standard, in my opinion. So the mitigation measure really doesn't address the impact to water, the water impact. So that's going to have to be, I think, looked at. The reason I asked about the traffic impact fees is yes, we have a long-term project that's in the queue there at Halcyon and Briscoe to address many of the traffic issues in that particular area. I want to know what this project is going to help. How is it going to help us in regards to meeting that maybe at a faster pace? and so forth. And so those are just how do I compute that? Certainly, something's going to be built there. Certainly, whatever's put there is going to be its contribution will be considered de minimis in comparison to all the other things that we're looking at for traffic and water. But I'd like to see something over and above as far as mitigation, if at all possible. As it's being presented this evening, I would not be able to support this particular project, but I think that we're moving in the right direction, and I think that with some adjustments that we can see a hotel at the site. Thank you.
Thank you. Mayor Pro Tem.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I don't have any great heartburn with the height of the building and the massing of it. I think if we were able to push it back about 20 feet, as Councilman Dickens has proposed, that might be a way of softening the look. But my major concerns were actually more along the lines of the water and sewer issues and traffic issues that have been mentioned. I know that the report says that the effects situation, the project contribution is de minimis, but we're at almost 98% use of water right now. And the 18.6 acre feet of the hotel and restaurant represents about a half of 1%. So that brings us up to almost 98.7%. So it gets us ever closer to being short. So I would also like to see if there's some sort of other additional mitigation that can be brought forward with this project. We're getting very, very close to being out of water. And yes, we, the city, asked for a hotel to be brought to the site. So in that aspect, I can support putting a hotel on the site. I like what I'm seeing here in general. The efforts to save the oak trees are genuine. I understand we're going to try and move some of the trees that might be in positions that are less than perfect for us. But I also question just how successful we'll be when you move them. I know they won't all survive, so we have to expect that we'll lose some. I also think that significantly sized specimen trees need to be brought in locations to be visible now and not something that's going to be 10 years from now. So I think those are kind of important. So I can almost support what I see in front of me right now. I think we're very, very close. I'd like to see a little bit better efforts at mitigation for water. Maybe move the building back just a bit. I appreciate that the entrance is now completely off of Branch, and I think that's appropriate. And I do look forward to seeing a project similar to this coming forward and being done very soon.
Thank you. I don't have too much new to add. I do have a couple of things that I'd like to sort of advance. One, I think I would have to respectfully disagree with this visual impact analysis. A lot of work went into it, I understand, but the rationale behind it, I guess, is something that I'm having some difficulty following. I understand the reason and rationale of comparing Trader Joe's in terms of its impact as you're approaching it, but I think it's very evident for people who are approaching Trader Joe's that it sits up on top of a hill and you're climbing a hill. Once you get to the top of the hill and you confront Trader Joe's, it's a single-story building when you're level with it. So, I'm having some difficulty with the height above street issue here in terms of trying to compare it to this. And I guess the same thing goes for Walmart. I have a number of issues with Walmart. One of them, to segue into it, gets into a comment that I wanted to make about the image of this building as you get off on of 101 onto West Branch, and I believe that's shown up on the screen. One of the things that fortunately the council supported and the city administration at the time supported when Walmart was going in was if you look at I've got a pointer around here somewhere. Here it is. If you look at this area in between the two articulated towers, and I appreciate that accent there, but if you look at the, I guess, the architectural plane between these towers, that was essentially the same issue that came up with Walmart. And what we insisted, what we at the time, the citizens group requested, and the council went along with it, was doing something to better articulate this flat plane. And so Walmart went back to the drawing board and with the charge to get rid of the boxy look, and they used some architectural material to put some definition on that side that faces 101. So going back to this design, I like what I see in the kind of the corner towers here, where you have the kind of the arch windows in arch form, and you've got a shadow box. And I'm not saying that you can carry that depth throughout the plane, but what I am suggesting is that perhaps Hampton Inn can step out of their norm, if you will, in terms of an architectural design, and put more accent on these windows. And if they did that, I think it would break up that section that. At least in my mind, has a kind of a negative visual impact off of 101. The water issue looms large with me, and this is certainly not anything that reflects on the applicant. This is pretty much a citywide issue. And I guess this is a challenge for staff and certainly for the council. I should make my position clear in terms of the hotel. I am very much in favor of some form of hotel, and this seems like a fairly logical site to put it. This is the type of facility that the city desperately needs, and I support it. It's embarrassing when we go out and interact with other councils and make a determination that we want to host something here in our city, and the first question they ask is there a decent place to stay in your city? And, of course, we do make recommendations, but it would be nice if we had more choices, particularly if those choices had small, accessible conference facilities, which is something that we very desperately need. In terms of the use, though, I think, again, the challenge for staff and the challenge for us is to make a determination as to build out priorities as we relate them to the water resources that we have available. We're going to have to make some trade-offs. We can't continue to build out the city of Arroyo Grande without going back to the drawing board and making some tough priority decisions about the type of facilities that we need that will, in fact, consume the limited resources that we have left. So that's a challenge for us is to establish those priorities, because clearly we cannot afford to continue with radical build out. Without considering priorities and where these limited resources are going to go. If we decide as a council that a hotel is a priority, then something else is going to have to fall off of the midterm, planning design concept, whatever the case may be, strategy, if you will. I'm not concerned about the sewer. I think being schizophrenic and wearing my sanitation district hat, I think we can accommodate the sewer, but the water remains as an issue. I'm also making the assumption, as we have talked in other other matters related to facilities that will be built in this circulation segment, that that nothing's going to happen on that corner until we have a traffic signal. And I'm assuming that's part of the grand plan, and that will certainly facilitate a better flow of traffic through that intersection, which right now, as we speak, is degrading in terms of level of service. The move, as was mentioned, to put access off of Camino Mercado and take it off of West Branch is absolutely essential, and I support that. Let's see, what else? Oh, one other thing, and I'll be candid. We've been burned by artist rendering before, and we've been burned by models, even though we prefer the model because we can see a better dimension here. And I appreciate the effort, and I know this wasn't cheap. So I really do appreciate the expense that was put forth to create this. I'd much rather have that than I would this. That being said, I've got to come back to the landscape issue, and I know folks who live on the kind of the inland side of 101 in the Rancho Grande area, everywhere along West Branch, each of them has their own story to tell about the soil. And having lived on both sides of the freeway, it's like night and day. In my experience, without a lot of expense and without a lot of landscape planning, nothing grows over there. Nothing lasts. It's very difficult to sustain any form of landscaping that would be intended to screen, beautify, enhance a streetscape. It's very tough to do unless you cart out all of that dirt and bring in fresh soil and have ample irrigation. It's very difficult. I think if you look at the hillsides at Five City Center, you see what I mean. You come out of Briscoe and you look at that the side of that hill that terraces up to Trader Joe's, and they water the heck out of that, and it's soil that you just can't get around, and it's very tough to maintain landscaping over there. So the landscaping plan that comes forth, and I agree with the positioning of the trees, and as was indicated, some faster-growing trees might be appropriate, but the manner in which they're planted, maintained, is crucial because it will make a determination as to the success or failure of that landscape that's put in place. So it may seem like a small issue, but when you step back and you rely on landscaping to soften a plane, and it never takes, and after a couple of years it dies out, then you have to go in and ask yourself who's going to replace it and maintain it and do it right. I think bottom line for me, the water issue needs to be resolved. I'd like to see a traffic signal there. It would be nice if we could get a restaurant out on the corner. I would like to see a smaller scale hotel. And I would like to see the frontage of the hotel onto West Branch softened even more architecturally. So those are my comments. I think with some of those concerns addressed, and they are challenging, and you know, the tree issue, I concur with the comments that have been made on the tree issue. But if we can continue to move this, and if there can be some give and take, I would definitely be favorable to this type of facility on this location. So I'm hoping we can continue to advance this, and hopefully at some point we'll have a hotel facility that we can be proud of. So what else do you need from us this evening, Rob? Jim?
Mayor, members of the council, the staff recommendation was for continuance to June 14th. We have advertised in anticipation of a development code amendment to achieve plan development PD 1.1 and specific consideration of this for May 17th Planning Commission consideration. I think if you're anticipating a smaller hotel or substantially altered design, that is too soon to expect the project to return if it returns. I think that this has been a balancing act between economic feasibility and site constraints. I don't feel that there is a significant probability of resolving the water issue in the a month that might be continued. There is a time extension granted to the office project. The office project is under its current condition valid for another 2 years, and it is my expectation that the office project may reappear as the proposed use. I cannot preclude the possibility, but if you do continue the matter, I would do so at the suggestion and recommendation of the applicant.
Okay. Any other comments? If not, is there an extension that would you like us to make a motion for a particular date and time if
I believe the applicants are present. If they wish to pursue the staff recommendation and continue it and have an up or down consideration by the Planning Commission on the 17th of May and the City Council on the 14th of June, that is the fastest the project could return. An alternative would be a longer continuance to consider architectural and resource alternatives.
Gentlemen, what is your desire? What we could do is go ahead with the staff's recommendation, give you an opportunity to discuss it. If there was a desire for an extension beyond that, we could accommodate that, could we not, Rob? Okay, thank you. Any other discussion? If not, I will entertain a motion.
Motion of the City Council to continue this item until June 14th. Is that the correct date?
I'll second that.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Arnold?
Yes.
Councilmember Dickens?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello?
Yes.
And Mayor Farrar?
Yes. Thank you. Okay, that takes us to item 9C, consideration of proposed resolution adopting state affordability housing standards and associated calculation criteria for determination of maximum sales price for affordable housing units.
I think so. Thank you, Mr. Mayor, members of the council. At the April 26th meeting, the City Council considered staff's proposal to modify the criteria for determining or establishing the maximum sales price for affordable housing units from the existing county formula to the state affordable housing standards. As a result of the concerns expressed at that meeting, staff was directed to prepare additional analysis and alternatives. Once again, Once again, the city has been utilizing the county formula for maximum allowable sales price for these units, which staff's analysis has determined, we believe, is results in too high of a maximum sales price. The City of San Luis Obispo and the City of Morro Bay both utilize their own formulas, which we believe are too low, particularly the one by San Luis Obispo. However, in our analysis, staff believes that the state formula results in a sales price that is within an appropriate level. It's a widely accepted standard. It will provide consistency with projects in the redevelopment area, which are already required to utilize the state formula. And lastly, it will aid our efforts to develop countywide standard affordable housing requirements. We are very excited about the progress we've been making in efforts to coordinate with other jurisdictions in the county. Staff has been facilitating meetings with representatives from each of the city and the county, with the objective of developing standard countywide requirements in order to simplify the process for both developers and lenders. As a result of those meetings, each of the agencies have expressed an interest in potentially taking our lead and also adopting the state formula. Also, at the last meeting, it was proposed that we all jointly contract for a legal firm specializing in affordable housing to assist all the jurisdictions in establishing or drafting a standard countywide affordable housing agreement, which we believe would be very helpful. And a number of the concerns, actually, that were expressed the last time we discussed this at the meeting probably related more to many of the terms in the agreement rather than the actual issue of the maximum housing sales price. And therefore, I bring that up because by doing this process, it will provide a good opportunity to both better review and discuss and address many of those issues that were brought up at the last meeting. So it's certainly appropriate to bring up the discussion this evening, but I think there's another opportunity where we could get into those issues in much more depth and analysis and be able to address them through a process that will also involve other agencies in the county. Meanwhile, it is important to try to attempt to develop some common standards and requirements, which will, in order to enable us to develop ultimately that standard-wide county agreement. Also, it's important to note that even if no action is taken this evening, if the county ultimately adopts the state formula, we may end up at the same point anyways with our existing requirements. One of the concerns expressed by the council regarding the state formula was its complexity, and it's really not much more complex than the county formula. However, it requires much more effort on the part of the city because currently the county is preparing all the calculations necessary in order to compute the maximum sales price. In order to try to simplify the formula and remove some of the subjectivity of the process in determining the calculations for each of the items that go into the state formula, staff is recommending that a specific criteria be established for each factor in the state formula. To do this, this table identifies the different factors and the recommended criteria for each one. And I'll just walk through them quickly. The first is interest rate, and we're recommending that that be linked to the HSH Associates Survey. That's a national survey of mortgage rates. It's very well accepted and utilized by lenders and banking institutions, and our research has indicated that that's a leading indicator of averages of interest rates. So we're proposing that. Property taxes would be determined based on the actual affordable housing price at that point and would be determined under the assumption that the property will be appraised at the affordable housing price, sales price. There's some question in that, but we're working with the county tax assessor on ensuring that that takes place. Insurance premiums, we're proposing that each year we would do a survey of 5 to 10 insurance agents and just average the quotes that we would get from them for a minimal insurance package. HOA or assessment, that is a figure we get directly from the developer as far as what the fee will be required for that particular development. Utilities are based upon the Section 8 program criteria, and they have utility factors that are determined by number of rooms, and so we can get that data through them. Really the only subjective criteria is maintenance. We think it should be very minimal for a new house. When we say maintenance, we don't mean gardening and those type of things. It's really just repairs to the house. So a brand new house should have pretty minimal repairs and maintenance. We put in $20 a month. It could even be less. Now, on an existing older house, we suggest that that be at least doubled. And then lastly, down payment. There were some concerns at the last meeting over an assumption of a 10% down payment. Many times these buyers are not able to provide a 10% down payment, so we had substituted that with the 5% down payment. It does lower fairly significantly the ultimate maximum sales price, and so that was a concern of ours because we thought the level before was pretty good. This is still an appropriate range, but it's also a factor that you may want to consider if you feel that it's dropped a little bit below where you think is appropriate. There's a little bit flexibility there. We also had looked at different down payments. There's certainly going to be participants paying a 10% down payment. We looked at the ranges of 5%, 10%, and 15%, and just chose 10% as the median between those different options. So I think either is a legitimate criteria that could be used. But for now, based on our feedback at that last meeting, we went with the 5%. One thing I wanted to mention here before I go on, our initial recommendation was to maintain this formula and issue first the maximum sales price on a new project would be issued at the time the project released the units for sale. After that, they would be periodically updated. We originally, because of the ease of maintaining this formula, we had recommended that be done on a monthly basis. Based on a couple suggestions I received at the last meeting when we discussed this, I did contact somebody from Mid-State Bank who was involved in their lending operation, particularly a lender to developers, and got a couple good valuable input. First of all, the effort to try to standardize countywide, he felt that was very valuable. He did have some concerns with the frequency that these rates could adjust or these prices could adjust, because he said when they're working with developers and have no, when they're shifting so rapidly, it's very difficult for them to make estimates on what revenue from those units can be. To lend on that revenue. And so he encouraged a longer period in time between which the maximum sales price could be recalculated. So instead of monthly, we're recommending that it be done twice a year, once January 1st, once January 1st, once July 1st. And then that price would be in effect for a six-month period, and it gives the developers and those selling the homes a little more stability to be able to plan out their finances that way. We've a simple table was created in order to provide for a vehicle to calculate these sales price figures. This table enables you to, or anybody to, very simply at any time enter the appropriate numbers into the table to arrive at the appropriate sales price. The table I've shown is an example, using Jasmine Place as an example, what the maximum purchase price would be under the 5% down payment, arrives at $254,908. So in comparison, that brings it somewhere, using the state formula, somewhere in between the current county formula, which I mentioned we thought was too high, and Morro Bay and San Luis Obispo, particularly Morro Bay, at $231,000, which we felt was too low. Based on discussions of a number of individuals, we believe this is within the appropriate range of what we're trying to target to serve the individuals that we're trying to target through the program. Now, at the last meeting, there was also some interest expressed in providing an alternate formula and maybe adopting our own formula. While we're not recommending that, we did work with the representatives from the Housing Trust Fund who helped draft an option for your consideration. It definitely is, it is established to simplify the formula, but it also makes it more difficult to standardize countywide, which is our goal. By doing that, it simplifies it by basically eliminating all the different housing costs that are incorporated into the state formula and uses just mortgage payments. And I have an example here, once again, utilizing Jasmine Place. Under this formula, Jasmine Place units would be $267,597. I need to point out, though, one of the major reasons for the difference in the cost is the fact that this formula does not take into account HOA or assessment fees. And so if you were to compare it to a project without an HOA in it, the prices would be much more, would be much closer. In a moment, I'd like Jerry Riau from the Housing Trust Fund, since he developed this, to come up in just a moment and explain it in a little more detail. First, I just wanted to conclude by covering one last point, and that was one of the other concerns expressed involved individuals who have purchased homes at the higher cost and what will happen to them and the value of their homes if they went to sell now with these other units on the market that are at a lower rate. The thing to emphasize here is that within the formula for resale, there's two options they have. One, the first option is that they can sell at the current affordable housing price. Obviously, under that option, they would, you know, over time it would pick up, but if they were to immediately sell at this point, that would not be a profitable option for them. But the second option is what is really set up to protect those type of situations. Their option would also be to sell at the amount they purchased the home for plus 50% of any increase in the housing price index. And so in those circumstances, whether or not you had somebody buying it at $300,000 one day and, you know, a few weeks later somebody bought a home at $280,000, they're both going to be using that same formula. And as long as the index is consistently increasing, they're going to both build up at the same equity under that criteria. So that provides some protection from folks in those categories. I think that's it. As I said, I'd like to have Jerry, just if it's okay, since he worked very closely on this, have him explain the other alternative in a little more detail. And I think he was working on maybe some historical data, too, that might help answer some of the other concerns that we talked about.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you, members of the council. The alternative formula is based on simplifying the state formula as much as possible. So I basically looked at the relative costs for property taxes, insurance, utilities, the maintenance, and took an average figure, subtracting that amount from the formula that I proposed to Steve. And rather than using 35% of the income minus the separate housing costs to come up with the monthly mortgage payment and then the sales price, I subtracted those items and used 27% of the income limit to calculate the mortgage payment and then the sales price from that. So for a house that has no homeowner's dues or special assessments, the two formulas will be almost the same. They'll vary a little bit from time to time based on the interest rates, because the higher the interest rates are, the lower the property taxes will be. There's a relationship there. For if you have a lot of properties that have homeowner's dues or special assessments, the simplified formula will not be as fair to home buyers, because home buyers who buy homes with the homeowner's dues and special assessments will end up paying a higher percentage of their income for housing. And the window, the number of people who can qualify to buy the units, will be smaller because the price will be relatively higher to them because of the homeowner's dues. I hope that kind of covered the basics on it. Were there any other questions related to the to either of the formulas?
Questions for Mr. Real?
I've got some slides that show what the different formulas have done in the past, including that house price index and how it would have been implemented for purchases in the past. We can't say for sure what will happen in the future, but would you be interested in looking at that?
Yes. How long do you anticipate this taking?
Oh, just a couple of minutes.
Okay.
What I did is I looked at interest rates, income limits, and other factors over the last approximately 15 years. I calculated what the county's price limit has been over the last roughly 15 years. Then I used the simplified formula, using a monthly change in the interest rates for 15 years, and then I used semi-annual change in the interest rates. So you can see how those compare. And then I picked randomly picked two dates to show how the house price index would work. So this is the county formula. The numbers are pretty small. It goes back to March of 1990, and it shows that in March of 1990, under the county formula, an affordable three-bedroom home would be just under $100,000. Sorry, that's so small. The county formula uses the 11th District Cost of Funds Index and the county median income, and the red line at the bottom is the county median income, as the basis for its formula. Those are the two important components. And you can see prices go up based on reductions in interest rates. As interest rates drop, the prices go up, and the prices also go up as the county median income goes up. So that's the county formula. The next slide.
Excuse me. The county median formula. The county median income is only about $15,000.
Nope, that's not right. It was. It's in the right now. It's $61,700. So I'm not sure what that number is. But the other number is the sales prices. This graph up at the top shows the affordable prices based on the simplified state formula. It again was about $100,000 in March of 1990, and it goes up based on reductions in interest rates. So when the rates drop, the price goes up. When the rates increase, the price drops. And as the median income goes up, the prices also increase. It goes up not quite as high as the counties did. The next slide shows the difference between this is a six-month change in rate for the alternative with the state formula. And it kind of smooths out the number of changes. Same general pattern, but not as many peaks and dips in the formula. The next slide shows the county versus the monthly using the state formula. The next slide shows the county versus the semi-annual. And as you can see, there are certain areas where they diverge and other areas where they're similar. Where they diverge is where the cost of funds index is significantly lower than the mortgage interest rate. The next slide shows the semi-annual increases, and I picked January of the year 2000 as a point to see how the house price index compared to the state affordability formula. So for the first couple of years, the house price index is a little higher, and then for the last year and a half or so, the state formula results in a higher price. They're not too different, except for that one spike. The next slide shows two different house price index formulas. So if someone bought a home in 1995, this is how the house price index, the light colored one down below, is what the house price index did over that period. And it's actually below the affordability formula for the whole period. In the future, if interest rates start dropping or start increasing as we expect them to, that'll reduce the price under the state formula and also under the county formula, and that's a period when the house price index may result in a higher sales price.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, this is a public hearing. And so I would invite members of the audience who would like to come forward on this item to do so at this time.
Mayor, council members, my name is Pam Denny. I am here on behalf of S&S Homes and the owners of the projects Jasmine Place and Parkside View Village. We submitted a letter yesterday. We're objecting to applying this new affordable housing standard, if adopted, to both of those projects. One, because Jasmine Place is always already in production and we have an agreement with the city. And two, for Parkside, because we have not only a vesting tentative map, but an approved final map, and those conditions are set and pursuant to the MAP Act, we believe that we should proceed under the conditions that were in place at the time the MAP was approved. With that said, we're not necessarily objecting to the new housing standard, but we wanted to point out what we believe are some flaws with it. First of all, the government code provides that moderate income is 120% of the area median income, not 110%. And that's pursuant to Government Code Section 65915 that addresses density bonuses for affordable housing, which both of these projects fall under. Second, when we asked before this council...
Excuse me, could you pull that microphone a little bit closer to you? Great, thanks.
When we asked the council before to adopt Senate Bill 1818 and apply it to both of our projects, which is addresses the resale value and appropriation to the city versus the home buyer, we were denied because we were told because we had a vesting map and a final map, we could not apply this new standard. So what works one way should not work the other way, in our opinion. However, going back to the current proposal that's before us, once again, 35%, in our opinion, should be of 120% of the area median income because that's what's provided by the government code. And 5% down does not reflect what it would cost a lender to provide mortgage insurance. I don't think there's a lender, and we have people in the audience that can address this, that will loan a 95% loan without PMI insurance. and that's very costly. That's why we've asked the city to employ a second so that they can reduce that cost or not have to pay it at all. So that's not reflected in this price. With regard to the resale, I've prepared either an overhead projection or I can hand it out. The difference it is between the two formulas.
We can put that up on the screen if you want.
With regard to resale, this was calculated to our best of our understanding by a CPA. So you can see for yourself the difference between how the current resale restrictions in the event of an unrestricted sale. Today we're selling Jasmine Place at $297,926. It has gone down from $315,255. The current deed restrictions that we are working under provides that one half of the average housing price index, which for 2004 would be 8.5%, that gain to that buyer would be $25,324. The initial moderate sale price at $297,926 plus the gain would be a maximum sale price at $323,250. If you were to adopt a new program and it significantly will be less than this, how is that current Jasmine Place home buyer going to find a buyer at this price? How is he going to find a lender at this price? And how is he going to find an appraiser, even considering the deed restriction at this price? However, keep going on. The market price for the same house today is $460,000. That is, the market price exceeds the sale price at $136,750. Of that, 90% is a gain to the city, even including the index price, which I've included, of $123,075. The gain to the buyer of that percentage is $13,675, plus the gain for the index, half of the index, the 50%, is $38,999. That's what we're working with today. The problem is that if we significantly lower these prices, we're not going to be able, these buyers won't have a market for their current homes. If we stay with it, even with the county prices falling or rising, it's not so significant that lenders are going to be frightened away and they're accustomed to it. We've dealt with many lenders now. The new formula, which is provided by government code, SB 1818, which we asked to be adopted, and we haven't got adopted, it's not being applied to either project, is a strict market price, $460,000, the moderate income price at $297,000, the difference between that, and 35% of that, which represents the difference between the two, which the city gets. Under that scenario, the city gets $57,104,000, and the buyer gets $104,970. This is the program that's in place today, not for Parkside and not for Jasmine. So there's a big difference there, and we just wanted to bring that to your attention. And this is how we interpreted the code, and we had a certified public accountant read both the codes to come to these calculations. Jasmine Place began selling pursuant to the county standard at $315,255. If you impose this on them today, that's a $60,000 loss in less than 6 months to these home buyers. Jasmine Place has not only got, in product, it's in production, it's selling, it's a DRE project, and the affordable housing agreement in its entirety was approved by the Department of Real Estate. I don't believe we can go back and change that. The county standard was approved. Going back to the new formula, when we initially saw it, even though it was quite complicated, the price was set on a 10% down, which is $20,000 more than it's being discussed tonight at 5% down. So we object to that. And once again, we don't understand
why it's only 110% of the median price and not 120%, which is codified throughout the government code and the health and safety code. I welcome any questions.
Any questions? Okay, thank you. Anyone else who would like to come forward?
Hi, Jerry Ryu again. I'd like to clarify a couple of the comments and questions that were just raised. The standard for affordability is in Section 50052.5 of the Health and Safety Code. It specifically states that 110% of the median income be used when calculating affordable housing for both for ownership housing. Section 50053 sets the same similar standard using 110% of the median income for rental housing to set the affordable rents. So while the income limit is 120%, the price at which rentals or for sale homes are set is based on 110%, so that people who earn less than the maximum income, the income limit, can afford to purchase or rent the units. So that's the difference there on that percentage. I'd also like to object and further a different position on the SB 1818. If that was the correct way to calculate the payoff under SB 1818, a home buyer would buy an affordable unit today, sell it tomorrow, get a $100,000 profit, walk away, and the city has lost an affordable unit. The correct way for calculating that equity share is to credit to the city for its share the difference between the affordable price and the restricted price. And that would go to the city first, and anything above that amount would be shared in proportion to the city's share and the amount of the financing that the buyer paid for. So in this example, for short-term purchase, the city's formula using the county sales price and the house price index as a second formula would net the home buyer a higher return than the SB 1818 formula would net them during this period of time. Over a longer period of time, there may be more gain to the buyer under SB 1818. I've been following, there is cleanup legislation for 1818 to clarify some of the issues in it. One item is to specifically tie the sales prices to the Section 50052.5 of the Health and Safety Code, so it's really clear that that's to be used. That's also the standard that's used for redevelopment projects. And many communities like to use the same standards for their redevelopment projects as their inclusionary programs, so that people have similar prices, similar expectations. The other thing that's being that's in the proposed amendments to the density bonus law would be to exclude that, or to change the formula for resale in inclusionary situations, so that the sale of an inclusionary unit would still preserve the value of the inclusionary unit at the sale. And that's in the Senator Hollingsworth, who carried SB 1818, is carrying the cleanup legislation. And that's one of a number of minor cleanups.
Excuse me, I have one question. The mention of the PMI, my interpretation, if the PMI was added, the sales price would actually be lower. So
right.
Your assumption when you talk about 5% down, you're talking about a 95% loan, but that could easily be an 80-50-15 split.
That's more likely. It's more likely.
The PMI anyways.
Right. Because the PMI adds such a premium that a lot of buyers have a lower cost by getting a second mortgage for 15% of the purchase price along with an 80% first mortgage, so there's no PMI.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else?
Good
Good evening, Mr. Mayor and Council. My name is Jack Hardy. I'm also here with S&S Homes. And there's a couple of things that we'd like to clarify. Also, if you want to go to the code, it specifically says that redevelopment does not apply to new housing. That's in the code. And the code, and I have it right here, section 50093, specifically says, and this is as of February 25th, 2005, it is 120% of the income. So that we believe that's important. But the problem, and I'm the person out on the front line that's actually having to market and sell these houses. The problem is not has not been the price. I want to respectfully say the staff is trying to fix something that's not broken. The problem is not the price. We're not going to sell any more units with this standard. At Jasmine Place, we have 17 units. We're going to sell 17 units. At Parkside, we have 16 units. We're going to sell 16 units. By changing the price, it will not get you or us as a community any more units. I believe there is a problem, but the problem more lies within the deed restrictions. And I have a letter here from California Housing Finance Agency that says specifically that. The problem's not the price or even the restricted price. The problem is the deed restriction and what's in the deed restriction that we believe needs to be modified. Up on the graphic earlier, it talked about the city of San Luis Obispo and Morro Bay having lower prices. What it didn't tell you is how many units that has gotten them, which is zero units. They're not building affordable units. It is resulting in no units being built. So how does that help the community? And the problem again is not the price. The county numbers, we believe the formula that's used now is more simple than what is being proposed to you, because we can simply take the county numbers, which we also believe are more relevant to us here in Arroyo Grande than numbers that are calculated using Barstow, Fresno, Bakersfield, Delano, McFarland, other communities that aren't as relevant to Arroyo Grande or our community as these county numbers are. So, and I want to echo what Pam said earlier. We have people at Jasmine Place that have already, there's some people that have already bought units, and then we have to relook, particularly on projects that when we come to the city with a project and then know what we have to do, then we can more easily evaluate what a piece of property is worth. When we bought the property at Jasmine Place and then subsequently at Parkside, we knew, or we thought we knew, what the program was for the affordable housing units. And now the rules seem to be changing after the fact. We don't think that's quite fair. We'd like to see that not happen on these two projects. We believe that any change should be for a future development. We are selling these units. Yes, it is not. It's not easy because we have a 30-year deed restriction. And when we go over the deed restriction with these buyers, a lot of times they focus in on the 90% that the city gets. And if they resell it to somebody that's not an affordable buyer. And, you know, we have worked at it, but the reality is we have some very happy people that have already bought. We have people in escrow ready to close now. We have just a few left there at Jasmine. And we're starting to gear up with the new project at Parkside. We just hate to see the rules change after the game already started. And it seems to us the rules are going to be more complicated than what we already have and not as relevant to our community. Thank you for your time. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you.
Any questions? Okay. Thanks.
Hello. My name's Gary Axelson. And I'm here with my association with Wells Fargo. We've been providing financing at Jasmine Place and at a number of other projects. And I'd just like to share with you some observations and some opinions as you try to figure out what makes sense here. I think it's interesting that the city's recommending to go to a state formula with a number of the other first-time home buyers programs, whether you look at an FHA formula or a VA formula, they have different loan amounts, maximum loan amounts, based on the counties within the state of California. Because obviously it's a lot easier to buy a home in Hemet or out in the desert, for example, than on the coast. So here, we on the coast, we have much higher maximum loan amounts available to people that qualify for the FHA loans or the VA loans versus if they're buying a home in Bakersfield. So as much as the desire is to get a very low sales price in our community here, you know, I think it's very easy to say, well, let's come up with a formula so that we can have someone buy a home at $200,000. And I think the reality is it's very punitive to whoever owns that land because they're not buying that land at whatever you're buying on a statewide average. So I think there's somewhat of a disconnect. I'm very interested in how this process works and how we come up with these tough decisions. I was on the internet all day today looking at what other cities have done to try to achieve meeting this goal, and I see a lot of things in common. It seems like there's seminars and whatnot, and many representatives from different cities go to the same seminars, and they perhaps get the same ideas. And I'm not convinced that perhaps that's in our second, like an 80-15-5. And we're grateful that you do that because 95% loan with the PMI was very punitive, and it really eliminated some people that that should qualify that couldn't with that additional price. So if you do look at this, please encourage having that option of having an 80% first, 10 or 15% second if you want to stay with a 5% down payment so that they can get around that PMI expense. It doesn't benefit them at all. It's not a tax write-off. It's not considered an interest payment, and it hurts them in qualifying. But what's really happening is people are excited about buying a home because they want to participate in the equity. That's really what it's all about. And when people get through the qualifying process and they really start to understand the deed restriction, we've had a number of people say, you know what, I'm not interested in this anymore. Because really, they're just a glorified renter. And so that's a challenge you have on how you can structure this. I think there were some suggestions in the past maybe to share a 50-50% equity with the city, and perhaps we could capture more buyers because they could get excited about that. But when they entertain making this investment and they're looking at a 90-10 split, just being in the streets, meeting with people one-on-one, I can tell you they can't embrace that. They're not excited about that. So perhaps there's something there you can do with that. There was a statement that about the special assessments and the homeowner dues. I think the reality is that seems to be the trend. I don't know of a project that we've done a loan on in some time now that has not had either an assessment fee or a homeowner's association fee. So I think you really need to look at that and understand that that's going to be part of their cost of home ownership. And I think it's really being naive to think that that's not going to be part of their cost. I was encouraged to see the resale provision improvement. Some of the things that we've looked at in the past where they tie what the sales price is going to be tied to is in has nothing to do with what the market is doing. And so I think that there's a huge disconnect there. If I'm a moderate buyer and my neighbor across the street bought the house at market value, and a year from now their house appreciates $100,000, and if my house is tied to the 11th District cost of funds or this other index and it's gone down $20,000, I'm going to have a real problem with that. I'm already a moderate low-income buyer. I'm at 95% loan. Now this house is worth less than what I put into it. Now, given the same situation, if the market value of my neighbor's gone down $50,000 and my house has gone down, whatever, whether it's 10 or 20 or whatever the index is tied to, at least we share something in common. So, you know, I challenge you to try to coordinate how we can establish this value with what's happening in the marketplace, because I think it's real difficult for people to make this investment, get excited about home ownership, but yet, because they have this deed restriction, their house doesn't appreciate or depreciate in the same manner. And so there's some confusion there.
The housing available. If you like, I will see to it that you get the most recent studies from Cal State San Jose. This program only serve to make middle-class housing more expensive. It is another arrow into the body of a shrinking middle class, which is losing both jobs and housing opportunities. Inclusionary housing does not produce more housing. It only makes market-rate housing more expensive. Somebody has to subsidize the homes, and it is the middle class. To lower the prices and increase the subsidy only makes things worse. The present city program, which requires a person to live in a house for 30 years to gain the full appreciation, is not working. Today, how many people stay in a house for 30 years? More people would be interested in the program if we lowered that span to 10 or 15 years at most. I think San Luis used to be 15 years. I'm not sure if they still are. This 30-year requirement essentially turns these buyers into renters. It does put a roof over their head, which is extremely important, but doesn't allow them to enjoy the full home ownership. It also takes away the incentive to make improvements, as the people will not last the 30 years. If we want to increase the subsidy, that is fine. But to offset this, we probably need to reduce the number of housing units. But most of all, we need to reduce this 30-year residency requirement. It's ruining the program. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? No one else? Okay. We'll close the public hearing portion of this and bring this back to council. And Councilmember Dickens, could you lead us off on this one, please?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I think there's a couple issues that were brought up by the public comment that I'd like to certainly address, and I want to look at the staff report and make my recommendation. I think our goal this evening is certainly a goal that we're trying to come up with a formula that can be stabilized, that can be predictable, and can be something that we can at least lay a finger on that's fairly easily dealt with our staff. The goal is not to necessarily reduce the cost. As it was mentioned, we're not looking at this particular action, at least in my opinion, to provide for more buyers. I think the idea was to provide for a greater range of folks that would then qualify. Apparently, we were able to find the folks through Jasmine Place that were able to meet the criteria, and I think there's plenty of those out there. I would have to ask, you know, if these folks feel that way and they're not interested, they certainly didn't go out into the open market and buy a house. If they're definitely low income or at least moderate income, they certainly weren't able to purchase a fair market home. And so I guess they continue to be renters or they move to another area. And I would guess that my opinion is that if an individual would like to at least participate in having their own home, that this would be much more than just a glorified renter. There are a lot of factors that are going to take place in an individual's life living here on the Central Coast. They may be moderate income today, but there's many, many opportunities for folks to increase that ability and 10, 15 years from now no longer be moderate and then move into a place, but it allows for them to raise their children in this particular area. So I think there are some distinct benefits with the amount of affordable housing units that we are providing. As far as the 30 years deed restriction, I I don't think that that's locking people into living in one place for 30 years. It's just a matter of keeping that affordable housing stock designated as affordable housing for a 30-year period. Our goal is to allow the individual to come and go as they please, just like any other fair market home. And again, they're certainly not going to reap the same benefits, at least in what we've seen in the last 5 years, that the fair market housing rates have seen. But certainly they're going to see some increase, and I think that that's going to be a benefit over and above just the fact of providing monthly rents. In regards to the deed restriction agreements that are currently in place, I think that I would agree those probably need to be adjusted. I think that there are some areas to which we need to refine the agreements to make both the lender and the buyer more at ease. But that's not the issue before us this evening. Those are probably issues we're going to have to look at and refine down the road. I'm pleased to see that our city, our city staff is certainly working with other cities in the county and trying to come up with a formula that's going to be accepted across the board that I think will help us kind of better get our arms around this particular issue. So with that, I think that our goal this evening is not to necessarily the outcome of what we're doing is not going to mean that there's going to be more affordable housing. It's just going to mean that we're going to have a better range of folks that would qualify for the units that are being produced. And I think based on that philosophy, I can move forward with staff's recommendation at this particular time. And the audience can attest to this at this particular time. There is no guarantees. We're not saying that as soon as you buy the house, you're going to turn it around and make $100,000, whether it's fair market or restricted. So those are the things we have to deal with. So with that, I guess I'm pleased with what staff has presented. I think it's a little easier. I like the amended recommendation to update this state formula on a semi-annual basis, twice a year. And I think that'll provide some consistency and something that will give us better range and so forth. The issue of how this is applied to the Parkfield, is that part of what we're dealing with this evening, Steve, in regards to whether this particular item, whether it does or does not apply to that particular development?
The way our current recommendation is structured is that it would. So it would depend upon you if you wanted to take a separate action. But the assumption within the recommendation is it would apply.
I would like to have staff's rationale as to I've heard I read the letter and I certainly understand the issues from S&S Homes' perspective, but I'd like to hear staff's perspective of why you feel the vested tentative tract map does not apply to this particular issue.
Tim, give the legal answer that I can give you from a policy standpoint, just the kind of the pros and cons of what we're facing here.
Well, I think the legal and the policy answer are very much the same. This is the first time the council has ever considered any policy. What's happened is we sort of knowingly fumbled through the process in the beginning, trying to develop our own standards. And across the state, I think other cities are feeling the same, this sort of inventing the wheel process. In any case, the council has never actually had this issue before it, formula, standard, or anything. This sort of developed through the conditions of approval that have been imposed on the maps. In this particular instance, the condition reads, and it's quoted in the applicant's letter, the applicant shall allocate 25% of the project or 16 units to moderate-income households through a 30-year deed restriction or other enforceable and recordable restriction. Said document shall be subject to review and approval by the city attorney. Sadly, I don't create policy. I'll tell you how this actually happened. The county number was simply the number that was there. It was easy to acquire, and it just literally was placed in agreements without any deliberation. I can tell you because, along with the city manager, we were the ones that did it. You've never had an opportunity, and we don't staff doesn't create policy, and we're painfully aware of it, and that's why you find us falling back very quickly and saying we never intended to create policy because we can't. It is, in fact, a part of agreements, and you know, if you're looking at an equity analysis, that's not what I'm giving you. I'm giving you a legal analysis. If you look through your ordinances, resolutions, and motions you've made, you've never touched this issue. This is the first time, and you know, certainly S&S may disagree with that, but I've been here for a long time, for 12 years, and this is the first time the council to set policy for the city.
In terms of just, I think, the trade-offs that you need to consider from a policy standpoint, as Tim mentioned, we think we have the legal grounds clearly to apply this new formula to the Parkside project. So you have the two issues, and I'm very sympathetic to both sides. I am sympathetic to the argument that we're, you know, somewhat changing some of the rules or criteria in mid-game. And, you know, from the developer's standpoint, I certainly understand why they would not want that applied to them. On the other hand, we kind of deal with this on many different instances when we change fees or change whatever, determining at what point they apply. We think here legally it's appropriate to apply them to Parkside. Also, in terms of accomplishing our objective here has always been to start off with Jasmine Place, use that as a learning experience as this is a new program, set what we thought was basic requirements into place and evaluate the success of that. And then when we go on to Parkside is to try to take some of that knowledge we've learned and adjust to help the Parkside project work better. And we think this recommendation, the key thing that it will do is it will help to better target or better accommodate those particular types of families or individuals that I think our program is trying to target to allow to purchase homes and live in the community. And so on the one hand, we're struggling because we have this fairness issue with the developer, but we also have a program we've worked very hard to accomplish, and it will be a significant lost opportunity. Yeah, unless we try to implement these improvements that we've now developed and apply them to the next project with 16 units and, you know, make it available for those folks that we think we want to target to get into those units and benefit from that program.
Thank you. I think just from my in hearing what staff is saying, and I agree with staff, and in regards to policy, it's Tim, I would agree with you as well. I think, though, in this particular, I view this as a little bit different than just development fee increases, you know, and those types of things. I guess when it comes to the Parkside tentative tract map that's been approved, I thought, and I'm a council member up here and making policy, I think there was some presumed assumptions. And so I would definitely support staff's recommendation this evening, with the exception that we move forward with projects after the park side. I think in my opinion, in good faith, the S&S folks have moved forward. Even though we haven't set the policy formally, boy, we've been talking about it for a long time, and there has been some presumed assumptions, and so that's just my perspective. Is we should probably not apply this to the park site. Thank you.
Thank you, Councilmember Arnold.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I'm going to kind of bounce around because I was taking notes as everybody was speaking. The first thing I think it's really important, it's in the staff report, it put it very well. If we adopt a state formula and if affordable housing were very successful in the state, the reality is while people are not in the current full-price housing market, they in essence would be in an affordable housing market. So therefore, if everybody was using the same formula throughout the state, you could sell a house here
and you could move somewhere else and buy another house. So while I think we're a little optimistic that we're actually going to build that kind of housing throughout the state, we have to start somewhere. And the reality is, if you're not in the market right now, if you don't own a home, you're not in the market, and there is no option. So this is providing a option. If you look at just the simplest formula based on what SNS handed out, Formula One, under the current restrictions, if you were to buy a home today and sell it tomorrow, you could make $39,000 based on their formula. It's a pretty nice return, considering you wouldn't even be in the market to buy a house. So therefore, while you're not going to make the same amount of money as if you bought a full market house, there is the potential to make some money in this. And I think the real key here is that affordable homes are not a lottery. I've said it before. It is an opportunity to get into the housing market. It's a different housing market, but it's an opportunity to get into one. The gentleman from Wells Fargo pointed out that most of the homes today are actually being sold in neighborhoods that have homeowners association and other fees. So I think, therefore, to actually go to a formula that doesn't take those into consideration would be a mistake. So therefore, you were actually making a case for the state formula. Lower sales prices are always going to be good for everybody except for maybe the builder. And when a builder's buying the land, he's going to do a pro forma based on, you know, what can he sell all the homes for, and that's what he's going to offer for them the land. So the land is not going to be quite as valuable. So I don't think all this cost is going to be absorbed by new home buyers. I think some of the landowners aren't going to make quite as much money on their land, possibly. So I don't have a problem with lowering the price. I think we are missing a large segment of the people that we were trying to target. Let's see, going to go through here some more. As far as even the ability to sell the affordable homes at the increased price, the reality is, by all definitions, we're not building enough of them. And so, therefore, the new ones are all going to be gone, and then people who can still qualify will be willing to pay the original affordable price plus the 50%. So I believe there will always be a market for the affordable homes. We're talking about a relatively small number of people here that are very small number of homes that are going to be available. So I just don't see this as going to be a real problem where people that are buying the affordable homes are going to feel trapped if they are unable to buy. As far as the appliant to Parkside, I am going to disagree there. I was going to ask the question of Tim if we could do it. And the fact that we have nothing in place, I don't know what SNS's formula was, what they used when they were calculating whether or not the affordable homes were going to be affordable or not. There's a lot of people out there right now that can't afford the homes as they are. So I will be in favor of, I guess, both resolutions if we're going to break it up, or just the one if we keep it intact. Thank you.
Okay. Councilmember Guthrie.
Well, I guess where I go with that, I think we're really only considering the one issue tonight is really what we're voting on, which is what I'll call the window of affordability, which has to do with setting the price of a home in the middle of what is the moderate income group. Setting the price of a home at the very top end of a moderate income is obviously going to make it much more difficult for people to qualify. It's going to limit the number of people. I'm glad you're able to find the 12 or 15 people to make Jasmine Place work, but clearly this will create a larger pool of people who could qualify. So I am in favor of the position going forward with staff tonight, and I do want to thank staff for putting together the spreadsheet so that we could work this through. Last time, I have to admit, by the end of it, I was pretty confused. I think the other issue is just real quickly that we're looking at is really a debate on inclusionary housing in general. I think that you have to remember that what we're trying to create here is not access to a real estate investment to someone who otherwise wouldn't have it available. What we're really looking at here is what I think Mr. Moyen with the San Luis Obispo Housing Authority referred to as treating housing as a utility. This is an ownership opportunity. There is more to ownership than simply an investment opportunity, although there is some investment opportunity here. This is the pride of ownership. It's the ability to improve your own home for your own long-term use and not be in a renter situation. I do think we have a lot of the third issue here is the complications having to do with reselling these homes in the future and what will happen. I do think that Councilman Arnold made it clear that you're not going to lose your initial investment. Clearly, if the affordability goes down and in fact your home is less valuable by the deed restriction, then it will be resold at market rate. They'll be entitled to their original purchase, plus there'll actually be some increase in equity, and it'll actually be the affordable fund that the city has available to create more affordable housing that'll take the hit. It won't be the homeowner. No, they won't make money like their neighbor did, but they still will. They certainly won't lose money, and they will, in fact, make some. So on the third issue of whether we apply this to Parkside or not, I mean, I think clearly we have the staff's position that we can do this here. I do think when we're looking at a 35, which I just quickly calculated would probably be a $35 million project, and we're looking at a difference here of maybe $250,000 when you include all the homes at $20,000 apiece, I'm not as concerned that's a killer for the whole project. So I actually concur with staff here that we would apply this to all projects going forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Mayor Pro Tem?
Thank you. I had one question for staff. We heard a lot of health and safety code, government code sightings, 120% versus 110%. And I'm going to ask for an opinion on this. Which is the one that we use? Maybe it's council's response.
They're both stated, one in the government code and what?
Down to an issue of what are we trying to accomplish with this? And we're trying to accomplish putting more affordable housing units into stock. And when a developer comes before us, if the project's larger than 6 units, then they have to comply with affordable housing. But they get a bonus for it, and if they want to increase the density and put a few more units in, then they're going to increase proportionately also the number of affordable units that are going to be constructed. So this is a partnership we're doing with the developers. Yes, it is probably cutting into their profit somewhat, but there's a social value to it, a value to our community, and that's the addition of affordable units to our stock. I'd love for someone to buy a house, be able to turn around and sell it and make all the money themselves. However, then again, that takes that unit out of the affordable housing stock. I think we've got a mechanism in place that will permit them to recognize some portion of the profits from that and get some sort of gain so that they can continue to grow their equity. And the portion that comes back to the city, I want to say it doesn't go to the city's pockets. It goes into the Affordable Housing Fund and will continue to make more units available to people so that people can afford them and make it easier for people to get into that process. All of that said, I can support the measure that's in front of us. I will support the inclusion of all projects, including Parkside, and I think that's something we should be doing.
Thank you. Well, a couple of issues. They've been touched on by other members of council, as is usually the case, going last. But I wanted to clarify a couple of things. First of all, on the presentation by several of the speakers this evening on this matter, there was reference to the health and safety code. There was reference to the housing legislation. You said that a moment ago, Steve, that you were going to do more research. We heard one version of the health and safety code, and then we heard another version of the health and safety code. Clearly, since Tim has described to us that no policy exists, no formal policy exists, that it was sort of put in place by procedure. If we're going to create policy here from from this point forward, then I would like, and I realize that we have a certain legal basis for that policy, and that it can rest to a degree with the council. But it would help if we had some ancillary legislation that clarifies and contributes to that policy support. So I would like staff to do some homework here and find out just exactly what the health and safety code says with regard to, I guess it was section 50093. Is that 110% statutes? I believe there was some attempt at some cleanup legislation that tried to give priority to the housing legislation over and above other state statutes. I'm not sure that that has been clarified, at least to the degree that we can rely on it. So I would like to get a clearer picture all the way around of the legal issues. On the issue of home ownership, and I listened to the presentation, and you know, I believe that the ground rules are fairly straightforward for an affordable housing buyer, and they know going in that the equity benefit is not going to be on par with the neighbor across the street or next door. But clearly, going into this type of a investment with 5% versus 20%, that in and of itself is disparate in terms of the investment versus return. So, you know, I'm not so, and there are also some other intrinsic benefits to home ownership that person is going to realize, and they're going to realize it from a source that doesn't focus on whether it's an affordable deal or whether it's a standard deal. Although the question is answered in a number of different forms as relates to credit standing and so on and so forth. Are you a homeowner? And for a person to be able to stand up and say yes brings with it, I think, a certain advantage. I don't have an issue with the with transitioning to the state formula, particularly if this is something that the other cities in the county are strongly considering and are looking for us perhaps for some guidance. But I do have to say that I am troubled with where we draw the line. Where is the starting point? And I've listened to my colleagues make some assumptions on whether or not we think, in this particular case, a developer can afford it or can't afford it. I don't think that's our decision. Our decision should be what is fair and where do we draw that line. And I understand what Tim is saying with regard to the fact that policy heretofore has not existed. But the fact of the matter is, the developer in this particular issue, as relates to Parkside, went into that deal with certain assumptions, and they were based on procedure that the city put in place. And I'm having a difficult time at this point going back in at this stage of the game and changing the rules. That to me is not doing the right thing. So, you know, where we draw the line is an issue with me, and I you know, I'm afraid I can't support going back and changing the rules. I don't think it's our place to, I guess, woefully underinformed as relates to some of the comments that Mr. Axelson made with regard to FAA and VA loans and how that factors into the mix here. At some point, I'd like to get maybe better educated on that. That's information that I don't think we've had a chance to massage. At least I haven't. And whether or not it's been made available is another issue. So I guess with respect to the issue that has been brought forth this evening, I can support transitioning to the state formula, but I have a real issue with doing the right thing and being fair to all parties involved, and I cannot backtrack and impose on projects that have already been moving forward based on assumptions that they got from us, and now all of a sudden changing the rules of the game. I don't feel that's right.
Question, Mr. Mayor? That being the case, then, you'd be proposing that the affordable price of the Parkside units would be based on the existing formula that we've been using?
Yes.
Can I ask a little clarification there, too? And is that every vested map? I mean, I'm thinking Camino Mercado. I'm thinking there's a lot of vested maps out there that have an affordable housing component that you're changing and not just Parkside. I just want to clarify that, you know, we'd have to assume they all made the same assumptions.
Actually, yeah, Camino Mercado has different conditions where the county formula is actually specified in their conditions. So Camino Mercado project would fall under the county formula.
What about Kevin Hunstead? And I probably can't name them all, but for instance, I think Kevin Hunstead has affordable units in both of his that are already under construction.
That's a good question. I'm not sure.
Well, then my answer to your question is yes. If someone came to us in good faith and we gave them direction and they moved forward with a project and they're vested in that project based on what we gave them, and now we're going back and changing the rules, then my answer to your question is yes. I think it should apply in each of those cases. You know, that's if we go back and we look at the fairness issue, I think that looms large here. And that's just my thought. We've always prided ourselves, I think, in doing the right thing. And so while I am in favor of doing this, we have to go back, at least in my view, and pay better attention to where we draw that line and where we start anew. And in this circumstance and in others like it, if they exist, then I, at least from my standpoint, we draw the line after that.
I just want to clarify, and I totally agree with that position in terms of how we treat folks. I just wanted to clarify, though, that the Camino Mercado project, we were very clear in the conditions in terms of what they would fall under. It wasn't so clear with the feral. So, yeah, I would think it would be one motion on whether to approve. In fact, I don't believe the resolution we even addressed Feral Road. So one would be approving the resolution that would be enacting the state affordable housing standards. And then a second motion would be designed on how you would like to treat the Feral Road Parkside Parkview project. Is that correct?
Because it wasn't noticed specifically for that project, although this became the focus since it's the only actual project that's being developed, I think if we took it, you'd be better off taking it generally. I know that if the direction is don't apply the vesting to Parkside, I think that's one thing. But if we're really just basically establishing when they vest, and I think that's what the conversation's now turned to, when is there a policy that they vested under, that anyone vested under, and if anyone did, everyone did. And I think that's how you really have to treat it. Otherwise, you're putting the city in a precarious position. I think by law, we don't have a policy. That's the way it is. And again, I said I wasn't addressing an equity issue. I'm addressing the law issue. You address the equity issue. But if you're going to treat Parkside one way, I would submit that you should be treating all vesting maps the same way. If they vested prior to today and if you adopt this formula, then they vested under the county formula. If not, then they vest under whatever formula you adopt. If you continue the county formula, it's a non-issue. If you change it, it is an issue.
How about this as a suggestion, since this second issue seems to have some meat to it that we don't have today, in terms of all of the vesting issues. But is there, if we went ahead this evening with a motion on whether to approve or disapprove the state formula, and then we do another agenda item that looks at the impact of that on existing projects, to include those who are, that have vested or not, and you bring that back, and then we can have an opportunity to discuss it in greater depth and make a determination again as to where we draw the line. Is that acceptable?
Yeah, I think that's fine. I think you're really interpreting a vesting statute, if I understand you, based on how big the impact is. Is that what I'm kind of hearing?
No, I think what we're talking about is policy implementation and where we apply that to the existing guidelines that relate to vesting. We're talking about at what point do we interject policy that we are now creating?
Well, certainly you can. I have some pause with it just because the way I look at this, it's a fairly black and white issue. You vest under the policies, laws, standards in effect at the time your application is determined to be complete, period. If you don't have any laws on that subject, and that's kind of what I said before, then you didn't vest because there was nothing to vest under. You can't, in my theory and what I'm saying, is you can't vest under a non-policy. This was just a sort of a creation of documentation. But I think we can bring it back and have the council look at it if that's what the council wants to do.
Mr. Mayor, I've got a comment to make. I found your argument to be fairly compelling, unlike something a few weeks ago. And in the
interest is to all vesting maps that are currently vested and a second policy going forward, because we're actually creating a policy in retrospect.
Right. You sanctified staff's policy, which was not a policy per se because it wasn't created by the council. And that's where I'm splitting hairs here, and I think you're hearing me split hairs. We don't create policy. We know we don't create policy. That's why it's here. On the other hand, we were doing something, and that became kind of a de facto policy.
The tug of war here is the old story about efficiency versus effectiveness. You know, doing things right versus doing the right thing. And I think what we're trying to get across here is doing the right thing. I understand the legal aspects of this. I appreciate the gesture of the Mayor Pro Tem, and if that's something we can do tonight, then we can give it a shot and see where it goes.
Absolutely. I think if you deal purely with the resolution, based on the comments that we've heard, we understand how to implement the resolution.
Okay. Any other discussion, questions, comments?
If not, if we go forward the way we're proposing now, I will be voting no that. And I'm not happy with voting no on this ordinance. So I would rather see it brought back as discussed earlier, because I think I'm doing the right thing. And so your quote, clarifying it that way, I don't think is totally fair. I do think I'm doing the right thing by applying it previous. I don't think we're going to get any affordable houses actually under this new policy, considering almost everything that we're going to build has already vested. So unless we start annexing,
there's still a lot of potential out there.
That's, I think now we're talking really far out in the future. So I would rather see it brought back personally voting no.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your position, and that's why we have individual votes. And we'll see where it goes. I would not have an issue either way whether we brought it back. You know, my position would not change. But let's try a motion, see where it goes. If it doesn't go, then we'll look at another motion. Did you want to make your motion?
Mr. Mayor, I move that we adopt a resolution of the City Council of the City of Rio Grande adopting state affordability housing standards for determination of maximum sales price for affordable housing units.
Is there a second?
Second.
Roll call, please. Or any further discussion?
Yes, there was a comment that the manager had made earlier that we'd like to incorporate into the text of the resolution right before it's now in the now therefore paragraph, right before this resolution shall take effect immediately upon passage. We were going to include the following sentence: the maximum sales price shall be calculated and fixed twice annually by the city on January 1st and July 1st of each year.
That I would include that language in the motion.
Thank you.
Okay. Then the motion has been amended and the second holds. Any other discussion?
I'm confused at what, since you read the, what is this actually going to apply to based on what is staff going to do?
Should we make it part of the motion?
I suspect it wouldn't hurt. We'll do it by separate motion. Why don't we take action on this right now, and then we can deal with the implementation of it, which I think is a part of it afterwards.
Okay. As long as we can take a break soon. All right, then there is a motion to approve the resolution as presented by staff, and there is a second. Roll call, please.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Dickens?
Yes.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Arnold?
Yes.
Mayor Ferrara?
Yes.
Mr. Mayor, if I may, to clarify the resolution just adopted, I would request that the council move to apply this particular resolution to tentative track map, vested tentative track maps that would be applied from this day forward.
Okay. We have a motion. Is there a second?
I'll second it.
Any discussion?
Under clarification, what is the policy regarding maps that are already vested?
For clarification in the motion, it would be my assumption that the policy for those tentative track maps that have already vested would be based on what the staff has been doing in the past in regards to the county formula.
Okay. Second hold?
Second hold.
On the clarification. Any other discussion? Roll call, please.
Councilmember Dickens?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Arnold?
No.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Okay. We're going to take a 10-minute necessity break here. So, Council, we'll be back in session at 20 after the hour.